This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 64, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday, I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, you will need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now over 60 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. So this week I'm talking to Malcolm Robinson about his book, The Falkland Hill UFO Incident, Scotland's most controversial UFO case. Malcolm has given lectures to clubs and societies in the UK, Ireland, Holland and France. He is author of 10 books on UFOs and the paranormal, and he went down to the depths of Loch Ness in a submarine in 1994. He's assisted television and radio stations all around the world with information on UFOs and the paranormal, and he is the assistant editor of the British Outer Limits magazine. He also founded the group Strange Phenomena Investigations in Scotland in 1979, making it Scotland's oldest and still going UFO paranormal society with members all over the world. Hi Malcolm, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi Simon, it's a pleasure to be on your podcast today. Looking forward to it.
So we're going to be talking about the Falkland Hill UFO incident, which you say in the book is Scotland's most controversial UFO case. But first of all, could you just tell us where is Falkland Hill?
Yeah, it's in central Scotland. It's near a place called Falkland. That's the biggest town. And your smaller towns called Newton of Falkland, basically just a small village. And also Fruke. This is in Fife, F-I-F-E, that's Fife, in central Scotland. It's probably about 40 miles or so from Glasgow, maybe more.
So could you tell us what Strange Phenomena Investigations is?
Yes, it's a research group that I set up back in 1979 to look at areas regarding ghosts, poltergeists, UFOs, Nessie. The aims of SPI are basically to collect, research and publish accounts relating to most aspects of strange phenomena and to purposely endeavour to try and come up with some answers to account for what at present eludes us. Now, it's fair to say that we don't hold any preconceived ideas or notions of the events of which we research, Simon. We tend to keep an open mind. However, on a personal level, the evidence that's been presented to me over 40 years of being involved in the subject have clearly shown to me that there is a continuity after physical material death, and also that we are dealing with some form of non-human intelligences that's always been with us, these UFOs, etc. So it's been a great journey. It's still a journey I'm on, thankfully. And it's just great to be part of it.
So this Falkland Hill UFO incident was really extensive and wasn't just something that happened over, say, 20 minutes. It was ongoing, wasn't it? So you tell us, how did it start?
Yeah, I mean, to all intents and purposes, this case is indeed quite staggering. It borders on the unbelievable. And even for me, it was really quite hard to accept. But again, having said that, we must realise that we live in a strange world with many mysteries that, I'm sure you'll agree, currently tax our minds, and it would be foolish to turn our backs on any case just because it sounds and looks ridiculous, which, admittedly, the Newton of Falkland case certainly is. And I'll obviously go through why it's controversial. But to answer your question, Simon, yeah, the events themselves started on the evening of September the 23rd, 1996, and probably from about 8:05 in the evening going through to just after midnight. So the story goes that Mary Morrison, who was with her friend's house, her friend was called Jane. It was a farmhouse. Now, this area is not like a built-up area at all. You know, it's got a lot of farms, etc., a lot of villages, etc. And they had run out of coffee. And so Jane said to Mary, her friend, "Look, yeah, let's jump in the car. Let's travel along to Fruke. That's a small village. The shop there should still be open. Let's put, you know, get another jar of coffee. So on that journey was 10-year-old Peter, who was in the car with them. And they drove along this little kind of B road. And it was dark. And as they were travelling along the road, suddenly they saw this. Well, initially it was a big, white, bright light. And then that extinguished. And then they were left looking at a large, black, triangular-shaped object, which was probably about 100 to 200 feet, partly above the farmer's field on the left and partly on the road on the right. Well, you know, they've lived in this area for many, many years, and they knew, like most people know, that this was not a conventional aircraft or helicopter of any shape or form. And so they stopped the car, and they looked at this thing, and they noticed that below the surface of the object, it was emitting two tubular lights, two columns of tubular lights. And they were moving, twisting and turning on the grass, part of the farmer's field and part of the road. So Mary got in the car again, and she flashed the car's headlights at this object, and at which point the object just screamed off and was gone in seconds. So they went to the shop, we got the jar of coffee, and on the way back, they observed the same or similar object again, only this time it came incredibly fast towards the car, so much so that Peter, who was in the back seat, was crying out. He thought it was going to crash into the car and we're all going to be killed. So they drove back to Jane's house, and in Jane's house was Jane's daughter. And they proceeded to tell the daughter, so I think she was about 16 years of age, what they had seen. And the daughter went, "No, come on. There's no such things as UFOs. Are you pulling my leg?" And they proceeded to say, no, seriously. This large black craft was out there. So Susan decided to say, "Okay, come on, let's go out and see if the thing's still there." So she jumped in the car along with Peter and Mary and her mother, Jane. And they drove to this forestry area. Now they saw coming up from the forest floor, green, blue and red columns of light. And I've said it before, you know, in interviews, that if you can imagine, and during the Second World War, the big searchlights that they used to illuminate the bellies of the German bombers as they flew over London, it was like a big searchlight, but they were coloured red, blue, and green. And they went, "Well, what is this? We live in this area. We've never seen the likes of this before." So they proceeded to continue driving towards this forestry area. They parked the car next to a little stone wall. And then that's when things started to get bizarre. So here we go. First of all,
there's high strangeness.
Yes, indeed. And it is controversial. So the first thing they saw on Falkland Hill, which is quite a tall hill, probably about a quarter of a mile away, was this large orange ball just hovering above the top of this hill. And it was sparkling, it was rotating, it was crackling, as if it was electrified in some manner of means. And then above their heads, about 2,000, 3,000 feet above their heads, they claim were beautiful, star-like, sparkly little star things. They weren't stars. It was a starry night, a cloudy night. Stars were out, but the stars were way up in the heavens, of course. But these things, there's only about 2,000 feet above their head. And they go, "What the hell's that?" And then suddenly this beautiful blue mist, they described it as a mist, suddenly elongated in front of the forest of trees. And then that kind of dissipated. And then in front of that, they claim, this is controversial, they claim that they didn't see 5, they didn't see 10, they didn't see 20, they didn't see 50. They claim they saw hundreds of small grey beings. Now, I'm sure yourself and your listeners are well aware of the greys, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, large pear-shaped heads, black inky almond-shaped eyes, great bluey translucent skin. Well, they were lifting what appeared to be cubes and canisters up from the forest floor and taking them towards a large structured object nestling just further back in the woods. To the left and to the right of this incredible scene was larger grey beings. And when I say larger, I'm not talking 8 or 9 feet. Again, this is controversial. She said at least 14 to 15, 16 feet maybe. Quite tall. Very, very bizarre. But that's what she said. And at one point, one of these tall beings extended its hand, lowered its hand down onto the forest floor for reasons. Who knows? Who knows? Also in this scene was a bright, fuzzy white ball, which was rising just above the forest floor as well. So at that point, things got even stranger. Because what happened next was, now, if you and your listeners can imagine a soapy bubble. Now, imagine that soapy bubble maybe about 8 feet tall. Encased within the soapy bubble was 1 to 2 small grey beings being propelled, being blown, being moved across this farmer's field towards their directions, towards where this car was. That was it. They had had enough. They screamed in unison. They jumped in the car. And Susan, who was in the passenger side, screamed out, "There's one standing outside the car." And at this point, as the car screamed away from that area, the whole area was illuminated in a terrific blue glow, just like a cannon shell exploded, blueness all over the car, all over the fields, etc. So they drove back to the family home and they were all shaken up, of course. Needless to say, they were shaken up as anybody would be. And that's the thing about humans. Not only can we get frightened, we get excited as well. So whilst this was frightening, they were excited as well. And they went, "Well, we need to go back out and see if it's still there," which they did. And they saw the same or similar events again, and then they came back to their house again, and then they went back. It's a long, convoluted story. Now, what is fair to say is that since that night and subsequent nights, they began to find, more so the two ladies, began to find bruises on their bodies that were not there before, discolored bruises. And we all know if we bang into something, you know, you'll feel it and it bruises up black and brown and black. Well, this, they couldn't account for it. This is very strange. They couldn't account for that whatsoever. And not only that, I should have said that when they were in the car before they sped away from when that blue light illuminated the car, Mary, a friend of Jane, felt that her head was being pushed down in the car. And also Jane claims that at that point, for a second, although it felt more than a second, she was transported to a different land. She saw different buildings, etc. She saw some very, very bizarre, you know. So it proceeded to happen. What happened next was a number of things. There was a strange burning smell that pervaded the family home in the days after their encounter. Now, they also have cats in their farmhouse. And one morning they were sitting having breakfast and the cat's water bowl was sitting on the floor. And then suddenly they heard lapping as if water was being displaced from the cat's water bowl. And they looked down and they could see it. They could see the water being displaced in the cat's water bowl. And there was no cat there, of course. There were also a lot of strange helicopters, black unmarked helicopters that flew over the property as the day wore on and as the weeks wore on as well. And I mentioned about the bruises, etc. Now, Jane found a bruise on her right shoulder. It was 4 inches long, which was very, very painful to touch. Jane had a big bruise come up on her right buttock and also a small bruise under her right breast as well. Peter did not have any marks on his body at all. But over the course of the following weeks, more bruises came up on their clothing. We have photographs of that, and some of the photographs are used in my book on this case. Now, when we were interviewing Mary Morrison and her son Peter at their farmhouse, Peter, who was playing with some cards on the carpet, turned round to me and said, "Mr. Robinson, why don't you ask the aliens why you're here?" And I went, "Sorry, what? And he pointed to the window, this bay window. He says, "There are three of them standing there." So my colleague and I, we turned round gently, fingers crossed, in hopes, with our cameras, in hopes of finally putting to bed the grey enigma. We turned round and we saw nothing, nothing at all. So I stood up and I walked into the area and I says, "What are they doing, Peter?" "Oh, they've just moved away from you. They're just moving away from you there." So I looked at Mary, Peter's mother, thinking she must be embarrassed by this, surely. And I says to Mary, "Can you see anything?" "Oh, yes. Yes, I can." "Well, what do you see?" "I see a shimmering, Malcolm, like a heat haze on a hot summer's day on a road, that shimmering effect you get. And I know, if I keep looking at it, these beings, these greys are going to just materialise it. And I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it." But clearly it was there. And that was quite bizarre as well. Also, she told us that on one occasion, she was in one of the bedrooms above in the farmhouse, and she had her forearms on the windowsill, and she was looking out across the valley because this farmhouse has got a sweeping panoramic view of the Forth and Fife Valley. And suddenly she saw above her, maybe about not even 50 feet above her, a machine. Something was moving silently and slowly across the roof. And it was like when you're a kid here in the UK, sometimes you get these Airfix models of aircraft, etc. And it was all, you know, they're all joined together in this framework. She says it was like that. The belly of this thing was like that. It was all boxes and tubes and, you know, it was all like that. And it just moved slowly above me and just gently banked away and was gone in seconds. That was followed by a bright red basketball light, which joined it a matter of seconds later. So that was quite bizarre as well. And I did say this was controversial. Also, little Peter was 10 years of age, and he had a friend over to play with him in his bedroom. So again, they're playing on the carpet with their toy soldiers, etc. And Peter's friend went, "What's that? What's that?" And they looked out the bedroom window, and I've got to tell it as it is, they claim they saw the small grey being hovering, floating outside this window, looking in, peering in the window. Now, at this point, there's not any outbuildings or any, you know, small roof that people can stand there. And, you know, there was nothing. It was just straight drop down onto the floor. And, of course, both little boys screamed at this, and this being didn't disappear. It floated. It floated upwards and was gone out of there in seconds. So, I mean, that was very bizarre as well. Now, on the 20th of October, 1998, I'm just trying to remember all these, there's so many things happened here. On that evening of the 20th of October, 1998, Peter's mum, Mary, was on the phone to somebody. And she had run a bath for her son. So Mary's on the phone downstairs, Peter's upstairs in the bathroom, and then suddenly she heard, Mom, come quick. So Mary threw the phone down, bounded up the stairs, burst into the bathroom, and says, What is it? And Peter claimed to that suddenly this small white being, materialized in the bathroom. Now, the difference here with this chap is that he had jagged teeth. Now, you and I know ufology. Your listeners, I'm sure, are well-versed in ufology. And you don't ever get, well, allegedly, small greys with jagged teeth. So that was quite strange. That was quite interesting as well. I think I've only heard of maybe one incident. I think that was in Mexico where these creatures had teeth. It was also kind of strange tar-like deposits found in the area as well. And I mean, that's just a small, brief look at some of the events that transpired in the Falkland Hill incident. Now, the reason I also say it's controversial is the witnesses moved away from the area, not because of the incident, but because it was a pre-planned move to Wales anyway. You know, it was on the cards. But what makes it so controversial, and I'm not shy in telling your listeners about this, it's in my book. Little Peter, he said, yes, one went to school with me. So me and my colleagues, we went, sorry, what? Yes, I woke up one morning and there was a grey standing at the foot of my bed. Okay, then what happened? He came down to breakfast with me. Did your mum see him? She may have, I'm not sure. Then what happened? He got in the taxi with me and he came to school with me. Really? Okay. And, you know, you're dealing with a child here. You don't want to sound excited or make him out to be nothing other than he is, you know. So we said, you know, did not your classmates see him? Oh, no, they never saw him. Only me. Then what happened? Then he came in the taxi with me back to my house and he walked through a wall when he was gone. And, I mean, that is controversial. Now, the thing I would always say to yourself and your listener is, and I've always said this on shows, is this. Just because something looks and sounds ridiculous, we should never, ever make fun of it. Because, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, we laughed at the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. What's that? That an aircraft? That'll never fly. It did. We laughed at John Logie Baird, inventor of television. That'll never work. It did. We laughed at Marconi, Thomas Edison. People tend to laugh at things, and we shouldn't, because this world, as you know, is far, far stranger than we'll ever know.
Yeah, well, this reminds me of something Whitley Strieber's wife said. When the book Communion came out, he got so much mail, thousands of letters of people with these talking about alien abduction experiences, just like Whitley Strieber written about. And his wife read every single letter. And one of the things she said about them was, the more bizarre it is, the more likely she is to believe it. So much high strangeness comes up in this field, doesn't it? It's that thing, I suppose, you start out hearing stuff and you think to yourself, oh, this is just going too far. But then months or years later, you're thinking, hang on a second, I've heard all this before.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do, Simon, is, you know, ufology is like a big jigsaw that somebody spilled on the floor. And people, researchers from all continents, all you know, walks of life across the world, all we're trying to do is nest them all together. And that's why I do lectures and write books, because I've lost count of the times that people have come up to me and said, Malcolm, I'm just going to tell you what happened to me. I've not even told my husband, but I'm going to tell you. And this is where you get all these stories, you know. And whilst they're lovely stories, at the end of the day, we still need proof. We can have photographic proof, but you and I know that can be easily hoaxed. It's not a problem with today's technology. So it depends on what the individual quantifies as physical proof. And I don't think, even though the Pentagon released the Tic Tac videos just over a year or so ago, and that was good proof. But I still think that it's up to these wee grey guys to really make their presence known and physically say we're here. Because other than abductions and lights in the sky and photographs, it's not really a great deal to be going on with, you know.
So going back to what happened, there was that point you said Peter was in the car and the UFO was coming to them so fast he started to cry. And then it changed direction. It's almost as if whoever is in control of that UFO realized what they were doing to him and moved away, like they had some kind of telepathic contact with him.
Yeah, I mean, we can speculate that may be the case, you know, and because UFOs had been seen in that area prior to then, but it was mainly on that big night that things transpired. UFOs were seen in the area by other people. Yes, we do know that telepathically, you know, things are put into people's minds. Maybe it was aware of the distress of young Peter. I dare say they were not trying to frighten the occupants of the car, but you never know. But I certainly don't think it was going to crash. I really don't think it was causing them any harm. But the big problem is the bruisings, etc. Now, we did offer hypnotherapy to Mary and to see if perhaps, and it's a big perhaps, anything else happened that night. You're a hypnotherapist yourself, you're aware of the subconscious mind, you're aware of kryptonesia, so easy to fool the hypnotherapist. You could be talking about something you read as a child, it comes out as an adult and you think it happened to you. So we have to be very, very careful by the use of hypnosis. But having said that, I advocated it in another Scottish case, which you know, did bring some bizarre results. We may talk about that shortly. But she refused the help of the hypnotherapy in this particular case, which is sad.
This perception seemed to alter in a way as well, because didn't they say they could see these beings in the woods close up, just as if they were standing by them, but actually they were still on the road. They weren't that close.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they also had some binoculars that they had taken from the house, and they felt that they didn't even need them because they were that close, you know. So that was bizarre as well. There was something was happening that night which affected the parameters normality.
And because they said, wasn't it that they had the impression they watched this for much longer than the actual time that it took to happen?
Yes, that's in the book, that happened as well. And that's like another kind of time displacement. Not only, you know, do we have abductions with missing time, we also have cases where we have these incidents where people felt that what they saw happened over a longer period of time, and yet it was only seconds. You know, that incident in the car, for instance, she felt, when the lady felt that she was taken somewhere and she saw these wonderful things, but she was still in the car. It makes me remember the case, was it Maureen Puddy, was it Australia? She claimed to have seen a lot of UFOs, and she asked these two UFO researchers to join her. And they jumped in the car, they drove to a location, and she says, they'll be here any moment, you wait. So the two investigators are sitting in the back of the car, Mary's in the front seat, the driving seat, and then suddenly she says, they're here, they're taking me now, I'm going, and she was still sitting there. She didn't go anywhere. So the question, maybe it begs the question, what happened there? Was it her astral body? Was it our etheric body that was being taken rather than the physical body? And that's something that we shouldn't poo-poo at, because, you know, maybe that's something to look at.
Yeah, I was interviewing a psychic for my podcast, Past Lives podcast, and she was telling me she had this time she woke up standing next to her bed and there were four greys in the room. And she looked round and she could see her body still in the bed. And that kind of freaked her out. And so suddenly she was back in her body and she opened her eyes and looked up and there's no greys in the room. And she said, there's no way this was a dream. It was completely normal perception while she was standing next to the bed. And that kind of suggested the ETs were in that astral realm when she was out of her body.
Honestly, Simon, I do believe there's something. There's something there. There truly is something there that they can affect. That they can affect people and take them out of their physical body. You know, so I do believe that's there. Yeah.
And do the witnesses talk about ever having missing time?
Well, other than Mary, who was in the car, she just felt that she was taken to somewhere else. But there's no evidence of missing time. Again, like I said, we didn't have the use of hypnosis to find that out.
Jane's testimony seemed to be quite emotional in places, in a different way to Mary. It's almost like, didn't she talk about some kind of unconditional love and seeing different space that Mary saw?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. You've done your homework, so thanks for that. Yeah, she felt that very strongly, that there was this unconditional love. And I've said recently in to the media about, you know, I was asked, you know, why I think these aliens are here. And I honestly felt that it's certainly not anything good. I mean, if you're taking someone out of their bed or their car and subjecting them to some form of medical or clinical procedure, then that can't be great. And yet, as you quite rightly said, you know, this lady said that all she felt was love, was tenderness, was love and affection. And I'm not saying that all greys or all species are bad. But there is an agenda there for sure, Simon. And, you know, in the A70 case, the other big Scottish case, Gary said to the aliens, and he said, why are you doing this? And the answer he got back was, sanctuary. Now, of course, we all know what sanctuary means, you know, a place of peace and quietness and love, etc. So again, what's going on here? Are they mixing with our minds? What are they trying to do? But again, there is an agenda. Goodness knows what that agenda is. Are they trying to look into our souls? You know, there's so many speculations, and nobody in ufology has the correct, decisive answer. They may say they do, but clearly they don't.
Did you find the witnesses to be completely reliable? They just didn't seem like they were making it up.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we only ever interviewed Mary Morrison and her son, Peter. We never got the chance to interview Susan. She's 16 years of age, and her mother, Jane, which is a great shame. I would have desperately loved to have interviewed them. In the book, there is a lady who knows them very, very well. And she says, Malcolm, no, they were telling the truth. Believe you me, they were telling the truth. So it's a great shame that we never got to interview them. We interviewed other people around the area, and some of them said they saw nothing. Some of them said that they did see things. I mean, like any given UFO sighting, what we have to do is to notify the local police, the local airports, the national airports, basically to find out if anybody else saw something on that particular night. And as it happens, there were none. In the book, I have some of the letters from the airports, and you know, they talk about base. I think there was one air exercise on there that night, but nothing significant.
Is this a spot where triangles have been seen over the years?
Yes, it is. Not just in the Fife area, but of course throughout central Scotland as a whole. Scotland, like any other nation, has been touched by the UFO presence. And we have the triangle-shaped craft, we have the classic flying saucer shape, like two soup plates joined rim to rim. And then, of course, we have the light phenomena, these balls of coloured light that's been seen traversing the sky. So it's a potpourri of different kind of shapes that's been seen in the skies of Scotland, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, when these incidents were happening, did the witnesses think to grab a camera from their house? Because obviously this was before phones had cameras on.
This is a big thing. I mean, we did ask the question. You and I would have, especially when we went back the second time, you got to go back with a camera, surely, you know. And clearly they didn't, which was a complete shock to me. What also makes this controversial is the fact that Mary was a subscriber to Flying Saucer Review, which is a magazine devoted entirely to UFOs. So she was well versed in that. She also subscribed to the 14 Times. So skeptics might quite rightly say that she was well versed in ufology, and this was a big story that she wanted just to tell, and then she didn't realise how big it would become, and then she just clammed up. Because I even lied to the press. I got interviewed by a newspaper, and he says, "Well, you know, where did this incident happen?" I says, "Well, it happened at Kennaway." It never happened near Kennaway. Again, the reason I lied to the press was to protect my witnesses, to protect the town. And, you know, it's like Bufora, that's the British UFO Research Association, has a code of practice where people have got to protect the witness and protect the locality until such times as obviously it comes out. But so, yeah, that's what we did.
And have you noticed any kind of phenomena where people might have a camera with them, but they just don't take the picture? It's like it doesn't occur to them to pick up the camera, almost as if the ETs have switched off that thing in your mind.
Yes, it's happened to me, and it also happened to another researcher. I'll give you Well, he wasn't a researcher, he was just a normal chap. So the story, when we look at that aspect, there was a chap called Ian McPherson who was a painter, and he went along to a reservoir, Craig Lusker Reservoir, which is near Dunfermline. And he was there to take photographs of the reservoir and then paint from that. So as he was there taking his photographs, he began to hear this distinct humming sound, this low resonant humming sound. And he initially thought it was the electricity pylons that pervaded that area. You know, we've all seen these tall electricity pylons. And as we know, if you stand underneath the pylons, you will hear a soft humming sound sometimes. So he's standing there taking his photographs, and then this humming sound go louder and louder. Well, what is that? And he turned round and he saw this hat-shaped object. And he couldn't believe what he was looking at. It was close proximity. It was only about 2,000-3,000 feet away from him in the sky. And here's where we talk about immobilization, because he had the camera. He had the camera round his neck. But for some reason, he was completely frozen. He couldn't use it. He could not use it at that point. We call it like the Oz factor. Jenny Randall's termed it the Oz factor. And what that means is it's like as if the witness is encased in a big Victorian bell jar. All the sounds from the traffic, which is about half a mile away, he couldn't hear. All the birdsong in the air prior to that, he couldn't hear. Thankfully, he'd managed to come out of that, and he took two photographs. And one of them clearly shows this object. And in the second photograph, which the camera he was using was a wind-on, it was just a speck in the sky. He was disappointed in the first photograph because when he saw it in all its glory, it was much more taller. But the photograph, when you see the photograph, it's slimmer. And he said that the top part of this object telescoped into the main body of the craft, flipped on its side, and shot away in seconds. He just wished he had got the photograph when it was, you know, the full shape. For me, what happened with me is some years ago, I met a chap in Alkby in Wester Ross in the north of Scotland, and he had told me over the phone that he was using a torch to flash into the night sky, and he was getting bursts of light or columns of light coming down. Would I like to come up and see this? So long story short, I travelled up to see the chap, and we jumped in his car and travelled a few miles to this area. Beautiful Scottish scenery. It was a lovely, lovely starry night, sparkly night, you know, the Milky Way in full glory. And he got his torch in his hand and he started clicking it. He says, "Well, this is all I do. Look, Malcolm, click, click." And suddenly this column of light came down from an empty sky, not attached to an object, just a column of light. Now, I'm not talking it was like way deep in space. It was fairly close. And again, I had the camera round my neck. And I was bamboozled. I couldn't believe or comprehend what I was looking at, Simon, you know. And I didn't manage to take a photograph. So getting back to your point, yeah, maybe these greys, call them what you will, switch it off. You know, they stop us from doing certain things. Like if you're lying in bed next to your wife or vice versa, you know, husband and wife try to wake the other person up that somebody's in the room. You can't do that. You're immobilized. So, they managed to switch us off for sure.
As far as the witnesses at Falkland Hill go, do you think they've had lifelong ET contact? Because didn't Mary's talk about blue beams of light coming in the bedroom window?
Yes, that's correct. She had that. She's also had experiences prior, you know, growing up. Some of them were more kind of paranormal experiences as well. And another one where she's not sure if it was a dream or not, but she was on board this object. So clearly, yeah, it would seem to suggest that certainly with Mary, she's had lots of experience of UFOs in the past. And when you look at ufology as a whole, you tend to find that people have been subjected to seeing these things or experiencing these things when they were younger. Not just that, it tends to go in groups. So their father and mother will put their hand up and say, oh yeah, yeah, when I was small, that happened to me. So whether that's a genetic thing, you know, they're looking at the genetic thing, I don't know. I just wish it would happen to me.
Because there's that thing you said that Mary had an interest, didn't she? She was reading books and magazines about UFOs?
Yeah, that's correct. She was reading that prior to the experience. Does that mean to say that the event is not true? I wouldn't say so. What happens when people are not interested in UFOs? Sometimes it goes the other way. They start to read about UFOs. They start to get the magazine. So, you know, that can increase and induce a lifelong interest with the subject, yeah.
And also the whole thing that they reported seeing, all so much detail and all this bizarre stuff. If it wasn't true, they'd have had to sit down and work it all out and back up each other's stories and also think to themselves, we can't talk about hundreds of ETs. That's just going too far. We've got to make it believable.
Yeah, there is that point, to be honest with you. That's a good point. If they wanted to just make up a story, they would have toned it down. But rather, it's like as if it's been elevated, you know. And again, does that mean to say that it's not true? No, it doesn't. Sometimes we got to listen to what the witnesses say. And I mean, I'm not a counsellor. I'm not that educated in human nature to a degree. That said, I have interviewed many, many people throughout the years, and I guess you do tend to get that kind of, you do get that feeling that they're telling you the truth. I mean, for instance, I was dealing with one lady some years ago, and I said to her, are you interested in UFOs? Oh, no, not me, son. No, not me. And I looked behind her, Simon, and there was a bookcase, and it was full of UFO books. And I didn't want to say, you know, well, what's all these books behind you? You just got to go on with the interview, take it on its course and see if they trip up. Yeah.
Did the witnesses talk about strange dreams as well involving UFOs or ET abduction or anything like that?
As far as I recall, I think Mary said she had a strange dream for sure. But again, is that real? Would that have been an abduction or not? And so, but again, if only we had have had more interviews with the couple, you know, with the Mary and her son.
There's no contact with the witnesses anymore, is there? They kind of disappeared?
They did. We have tried to locate them. They've moved down to Wales. The other one, we're not even sure where Jane has gone to and Susan. And again, sceptics would say that's because it's a whole hoax. It's a total hoax. They've made it all up. They don't want to be interviewed because then the cat's out of the bag, etc. Or on the flip side of that coin, it truly, truly did happen. The story's out there now, okay, albeit not so much Jane and Susan's, you know, recollections, etc. But maybe they want to leave it. Some people just want to drop it and just leave it, you know, and we can understand that. And I've spoken to witnesses throughout the years who said, look, happy to tell you my story, Malcolm, but for goodness sake, don't put it in the news, don't put it in any books, etc. And for every five people who report a UFO, how many people behind them who also saw it doesn't put their hand up and say, yep, I saw it? We're talking about the fear factor here. We're talking about the reluctance by witnesses to come forward. And because we all know, I mean, I've been ridiculed in the press many, many times. It comes with the job, I guess. But all we're trying to do is impress upon Joe Public that these things are real. They've always been with us. They've been with us since time immemorial. And we see it in cave paintings, Renaissance paintings, etc. So the big question is, okay, they've been with us through time immemorial. When are they physically actually going to put their hands up and say, we're here? That gets back to my earlier question, is there is an agenda? Is there their agenda finished yet? What is it?
Well, it could be like the human race. If aliens came here and said, what's the human's agenda? You might say, well, the Russians' agenda is different to Australia's or North Korea's. It could be with the ETs, there's all sorts of agendas.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That it's all but speculation at the moment of what that agenda is. Some people say that they're trying to get into our souls. They're trying to find out about the spirit side of life. And maybe they don't have continuity after physical material death. They're trying to find out how we can, how humans can. Some people say that it's some alien genetic interbreeding program, which smacks of Star Trek, etc. But does that make it any less ridiculous? Probably not. I personally spoke to a lady who had been abducted, and she was re-abducted, and she met this creature on board this craft, and this creature was holding in its arms a hideous half-human, half-alien hybrid child. And this, through telepathy, the alien said to this lady, "It's you. It's part of you." The thing is, you know, they've been taking sperm and ova from males and females for hundreds of years now. Why, oh, why, oh, why are they still doing this procedure? Clearly, they could have got that through any hospital, but I think it's the interaction with humankind. They need that very interaction with humankind just to make things happen. It appears to me, anyway.
And as far as investigating this case, didn't you get an anonymous email threatening you?
Oh, yes, I did. I did, to stay away from the case. There was also another gentleman who claimed it was me. He was knocking on doors in Newton and Falkland and saying, "Yes, my name is Malcolm Robinson. There was a UFO appeared in this area a few weeks ago. And did you see or hear anything?" Now, that wasn't me. I was working at a factory in the town of Alloa in Clackmannanshire that particular day. And the good news is I can back that up with my boss's testimony that I was there, my workmate's testimony. But that caused me a lot of grief, a lot of problems from fellow Scottish ufologists who says, "Malcolm, that's bloody ridiculous. You shouldn't be doing that, harassing witnesses." Whoa, I never harassed anybody. I wasn't even there. And it's the same with when you get in the newspapers or that. Why did you say that, Malcolm? I went, "I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all." And that's the problem when you work with the media. You know, they'll put arms and legs in a story. They'll give it salt and pepper. I know. I've done it all throughout the years. It's just part of the game, isn't it, really?
And was there a time you were going to talk at the conference and the witnesses asked you not to discuss this case?
Well, allegedly that came through another Scottish ufologist who emailed me up and said they don't want you to speak about it. And everybody was looking forward to the Falkland Hill case at this big, big conference. It was building the programmes, it was building the newspapers. And probably at the 11th hour, even though I wasn't sure if it truly, truly was true, I mean, it's only coming from another researcher, I had to say to the Congress organiser, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to bail out of that, but give you a different talk." And to this day, I don't know if that was true or not, or somebody just wanted to stop me talking about it. I mean, I've spoken about it for years now, you know. I'm speaking to your good self and your lovely listeners. And the reason we do talk about it is just to get the story out there and see if anybody who's listening to your show can say, "You know, you spoke about these greys with jagged teeth. Yeah, I can relate to that. I saw one." This is why we talk to people like yourself, Simon. Some of your listeners may have a piece of the jigsaw. "Malcolm, here you go. I know exactly what's going on." And that's why we do it. It's not for glory or fame. You know, I've written 11 books now. You don't make money out of writing books, believe you me. Pennies, really. It's just to get the story out there and to the public domain.
And also, with the witnesses of the case, you didn't use their real names. You kept them anonymous.
Yeah, we do that with any witness. I mean, with the current book I'm writing just now, which is Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4, I always ask the people who are sending me these stories, etc., if I can use their real name or a pseudonym. And it's 50-50. Some people say, "Yeah, not a problem with that." And others say, "No, please don't. You can give me a pseudonym," you know. But yeah, with the Falkland case, it's only right and proper that we didn't use the real names. But any serious researcher, of course, we do have the real names on file. Not only that, but we also have in file the audio tape recordings that we made of Mary Morrison and Peter at their family home. And you can clearly, clearly hear Peter saying, you know, there are aliens there, and Mary talking about all her experiences, etc. So for anybody that says it's that we made it up, you know, then we have the backup of the audio tape testimony as well.
And did Mary say something about a ghost of a dog in the house?
Yeah, that's what she spoke about, this ghostly dog. It was walking about the house. And when we look back to what I said earlier, the cat's water bowl, it was being displaced by the lapping of possibly this ghostly dog. So it seems that they were part and parcel of the paranormal flooded over to ufology as well, you know. So that was pretty bizarre.
Yeah, it's all connected in some way, isn't it? The ET stuff and what you might call spiritual stuff. It's not just creatures in metal starships traveling around. There's something more undescribable about it.
Oh yeah, for sure. And but I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of that particular case unless, of course, Jane and Susan come forward. It would be great to speak to Mary and Peter now in 2023, just to see if they how they feel about it, you know, their own take on it. Can they remember anything else? Because sometimes certain witnesses don't recall things to weeks or months later, and suddenly they'll get a flashback of something that happened that night. So they may well be more hands and head and hands more than what was told to me on that particular evening.
You've been researching this for a long time. Are there any trends you see over time or were there things you might have seen in the 90s that just don't show up anymore?
Good question. I would say pretty much everything's been more or less the same, other than the jagged teeth from that small grey being. I've never heard anything bizarre as that before. You know, it's all conformed to the kind of same thing, the same UFOs, the same greys, etc. So not that anything that springs to mind just now.
And there's this thing, I suppose UFO designs are so varied. People see a disc, but when they get into the detail, the discs all seem so different from each other, and the triangles have little differences about them as well. And I sometimes wonder if what somebody sees is affected by the ETs in some way, you know, that thing of screen memories where people see.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The screen memory obviously came into the public domain mainly through Whitley Strieber, and he saw a lot of owls outside his home, and then obviously they kind of transmorphed into these small grey beings as well. So there is that, and you know, that's part and parcel of the UFO enigma as well, with these what we call shapeshifters. It could be owls, it could be deers, anything at all. Makes you wonder why they're doing that. They're trying to kind of please the witness, in the sense that they don't want them to be too alarmed. It's a possibility. Again, it goes back to we don't have all the answers, but there's no denying that people initially started to see the shapes of animals morph into these aliens, and it's just that other part of the jigsaw again, yeah.
It's been fascinating talking to you, and we were talking about the Falkland Hill UFO incident. That's the name of the book, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. That's available from Amazon. And, you know, if you want to get a copy of that, see what it's all about, then please do.
And you have a website?
Not a website as such. I have my own Facebook site. And so if you type in Facebook, Malcolm Robinson, you may find a number of Malcolm Robinsons, because everybody's got the same name. But if you look for my Facebook, which has a photograph of the Socky Poltergeist books, then you'll know that you're on the right page.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
Simon, it's a pleasure. And ending, all I would say is, you know, just people, just open up your hearts, open up your minds, you know, because there clearly is something out there. I would not be involved in the subject if I honestly didn't believe there was something real, something tangible out there. So keep up your interest. All the very best.
And that was an interview with Malcolm Robinson about his book, The Falkland Hill UFO Incident, Scotland's Most Controversial UFO Case. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you can get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 250 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories, and that will almost always have UFO information. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And my Instagram is Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. You had a psychic channel come with you to the interview and go to the site. What happened with them?
Yeah, I mean, again, we got a lot of stick from other Scottish ufologists on that. And we'll speak to and listen to anybody who feels...